It's 10:06. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. The new book, The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires, chronicles the development of four of the major communications technologies of the last century: telephone, motion pictures, radio, and television, and talks about how they went from being free and open to all to under the control of moguls and corporations. His premise is that the Internet may be headed the same way. Tim Wu is professor of law at Columbia University and author of The Master Switch, and he joins me by phone. Professor Wu, good morning and welcome to the program.
Good morning. It's a pleasure.
Before we start talking about your book, Professor, I wonder if you'd give us your take on the FCC action yesterday regarding net neutrality.
Sure. I'm in a radio studio right now, actually, in New York. I spent all day talking about the same thing. There is now a federal net neutrality rule in the United States. I think it's good news. Obviously, the rule was weaker than some people would have liked, and there's some real questions about the wireless side, i.e., what about the Internet when it comes to your wireless phone? But I regard it as a positive development.
That question, I guarantee that some of our listeners are probably going to bring that up at some point during the hour, and I think it may, it certainly plays into what you're talking about in the book. Talk about how you got the idea for the book, The Master Switch. What was it about the development of the Internet that made you feel like we'd been there before?
Well, this is what was interesting. I worked in Silicon Valley earlier in my life, during the first dot-com boom. And one of the things that struck me about that time was there was a sense when we were there that what we were living through had never happened before, that we were rewriting history, that everything was new and there was nothing to learn from old media. And eventually when I got into academia, I started to wonder, was that really true? Wasn't there these other periods that might have been similar? And so I started doing a lot of research and spent years on this. And lo and behold, what do you find out? Radio in the 1920s, everyone thought, wow, this is the new amateur, crazy young media. Everyone's involved in it. Telephone, 1910 approximately, or 1900. Everyone's starting their own phone companies, and it's like a gold rush of the phone era. Film has its own sort of open era. And so I started noticing there was these periods that were very similar, and I thought, well, what happened to them? And that's what got me started on the book.
You make reference to something you call the cycle. Talk about that, please.
Sure, yeah, sure. So one thing, if you look carefully at the history of communications and information industries, what tends to happen is there's a new invention. Some genius comes up with something new, whether it's a telephone or it's the radio transmission. And that usually leads to these unusual periods of openness, entrepreneurship, highly competitive markets, where it's kind of like everyone's getting into it, a boom, basically. In 1921, there were radio stations, on a radio station right now, went from there was probably 10 or something to thousands of radio stations. Everyone's excited about it. And you have these eras, they tend to last for about 10 years, 10 to 15 years of openness. And then the cycle is that slowly that industry, extremely open and vibrant, begins to slowly consolidate and close. And it repeats itself over and over again. That's why we call it the cycle. That the industry begins to consolidate, close, become dominated by a monopolist or a cartel, often a single man who has a vision for the industry. And then that can last for a very long time until it itself is blown up by another invention or sometimes by the federal government. So that's the idea of the cycle.
And a great illustration of that is in the very beginning of your book when you talk about the battle between the telephone and the telegraph, AT&T and Bell Telephone versus the behemoth Western Union.
Yeah, it's a great story. So you have to sort of rewind our minds into the late 19th century, and here we are. The only way to move information from one place to another instantly is telegraph. That's it. They have and Western Union has a very comfortable monopoly, a very powerful company, a very unrestrained company. There's no oversight at all, and they use their power to do things like try to throw elections and spy on people. They're pretty much the classic example of an unrestrained monopoly power being abused.
Well, in your book, you sort of give credit to Western Union and Associated Press for the election of Rutherford B. Hayes.
Yeah, I'm not the only one. A lot of people believe the telegram had a decisive role, But there's a lot involved in that election, but had an influential role in electing Hayes in 1876. One of the main reasons is that the telegraph company was allied with the Republican Party. And so they just handed over the telegrams, from the Democrats. And they found out, for example, the Democrats weren't sure about their victory in the South, and so they went and challenged all the states. So, yeah, they had this, this was a completely unrestrained monopolist who basically just ran wild with all the power you can have from owning the world's only, or the nation's only instantaneous network. So the story is you have Western Union, they've a very powerful and monopoly, and this startup, three-man startup, Alexander Bell and his backers, basically family members, sort of early VCs, invent the telephone, and at first Western Union doesn't really think it seriously, but eventually they realize this thing could be a challenge to them, so they try and destroy it. And so you have this classic battle of the new technology against the existing monopoly. It's something that repeats itself over and over again. And they come pretty close to destroying Bell. In fact, another kind of alternate vision of history, Bell would have never started. And what's interesting is Western Union's idea of what the telephone should be was kind of an adjunct to the telegraph. So you might call into the local office and say, hey, my telegraph's arrived. They didn't have this idea of the phone actually replacing the telegraph. And so you have this, battle, which eventually Bell survives because it has a strong federal patent, and they live on, and eventually they end up destroying and buying Western Union. So it is the classic story of the disruptive technology upseating the incumbent, but it doesn't always go that way. Sometimes the incumbent wins.
Well, yeah, you talk about that, and you invoke the ancient Greek god Kronos to describe the process that can happen to a new technology.
Yeah, it's a kind of visually exciting image, and maybe a little graphic for public radio. But the ancient ruler of the universe, Kronos, I think the second ruler of the universe in Greek mythology, it was foretold that one of his children would replace him. And so that being the case, he came up with a straightforward solution. When his children were born, he would simply eat them for breakfast, and that way prevent being usurped. And that's basically what happens in tech markets. People look around, look at Comcast now looking at Netflix, let's say. They see this new thing, people like it, and everyone's trying to figure out, like right now, how do we eat Netflix for breakfast because we don't want them replacing cable? That's the kind of thing that happens. They don't always eat them or kill them. Sometimes they'll buy them out. Sometimes they'll co-op them. But, it's just natural. No one who's in power wants to lose power in the worlds of information, and so they do what they can to destroy their competitors.
Yeah, if you can't beat them, eat them, I guess would be the phrase there. So we had the telephone kind of replacing the telegram at some point. You make the point that the biggest thing that Bell had going for them was a strong federal patent, and that was it. They didn't have anything else.
They kind of had they had a phone, but it was inferior, in fact. And, of course, everyone thinks of Alexander Bell as the inventor of the telephone. It's quite disputed. Having read the history quite carefully, in terms of who invented the ancestor of the practical working phone we have now, I'd have to say Thomas Edison had a pretty serious role in that, not well known. And the reason is that Western Union, the monopolist, said, hey, this phone's a good idea. Let's get the smartest guy out there to make a good one. And they hired Edison, said, we need a phone. He produced a phone, and that's basically the ancestor to the phones we see today. Alexander Bell did some stuff. But anyway, they had the thing is, though, that Bell did have a patent, and they managed to scare off Western Union enough so that they started their own telephone monopoly and eventually rose and got old enough. This is sort of a revenge thing. Eventually they got old enough to get big enough and buy out Western Union. It's a common pattern that a company tormented in its youth will kind of go back and try and buy the company that made it miserable. You can see that today with Comcast. I keep bringing up Comcast. I don't know why. But anyway, Comcast is trying to buy NBC. NBC, for decades, made the lives miserable of the cable companies because they didn't like them.
Interesting. There's so many different and very fascinating aspects of this book. One of the problems I had was trying to find a way to communicate some of this stuff in an hour-long radio broadcast. One of the things, I guess, that intrigued me, because I consider myself something of a radio historian,
right?
Because I've been in the business long enough to qualify, the early days of radio and the early days of the internet, I really like the comparisons that you draw there. And in particularly the development of the technology itself and all the different people who had a hand in it. But before I forget this, I wanted to ask you about the title of your book and the Fred Friendly quote from which it came.
Sure. Well, you know, the funny thing is the original title of the book was Open. But then we found out that Andre Agassi was publishing under the same title, same publisher. So we changed. And we changed to this title, The Master Switch, which... It is a quote from Fred Friendly, who's the famous journalist, very active in public television, and also famously undermined the McCarthy in that program, Hear It Now. And he had this quote where he said, at stake in this debate, he was talking about the control of broadcasting, and he said, you know, it's not just the First Amendment or free speech, but it's exclusive custody of the master switch. And this quote gave me this idea that we have these discussions about speech and the First Amendment, they're very superficial. What really matters is who controls the channels of communication. You can kind of see that today with WikiLeaks. You know, the debate over WikiLeaks is partially a debate over free speech, but it's partially a debate over can you get to this stuff or not. And there's a level below the free speech debate, which is more fundamental, in my opinion, more important, as to can the information get out at all. And that's the title, The Master Switch. Relates to.
Well, that's kind of what's at stake with the net neutrality debate, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, the net neutrality debate is the argument in net neutrality is to say, okay, well, these obviously the cable and phone companies control the physical internet. You know, they got it. And it's sort of not to make them not act as a master switch. In other words, to force them to carry everything equally is to say, yes, we know you're the gatekeeper, but you got to play fair and deliver all content the same and not block stuff. A country that has the opposite policy is a country like China, where, you know, they don't like something, they just block it. And that's an example of how that underlying level of control is more important than even law or anything else.
We're talking about the new book, The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires by Tim Wu. Tim Wu is with us on the phone this morning, and certainly available for your questions about this idea of the cycle of the way information technologies rise, become empires, and then get either supplanted by something else or sort of ossify under some sort of monopoly control. And we're discussing that this morning, this hour. If you'd like to join us, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. That's the telephone number to call. You can also send an email. We'll combine technologies here today. You can also send an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. And the Kathleen Dunn Show is also on Facebook. You can find that page, leave a comment, and then we'll turn it into radio. 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. It's 20 minutes after 10 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Coming up after 11:45 today on Larry Mueller's program, for over 20 years, a Wisconsin syndicated outdoor adventure columnist has not missed a weekly deadline. After 11:45, Larry Mueller's guest is Mark Walters of Nisida, whose column is called An Outdoorsman's Journal and runs in 67 newspapers. That's on the Larry Mueller program after 11:45 today. This hour, we're talking about the book, The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. My guest is Tim Wu, professor of law at Columbia University, and the author of the book under discussion. The phone number to join us, 800-642-1234. And we have some callers who want to join us, so let's go right to a call, and we'll start in Viroqua with Janelle. Janelle, good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to add that all this about control, that this issue of control that your guest is talking about, I think that is very much what is behind the government getting so upset about the WikiLeaks. And in fact, wanting to use this particular man, I can't remember his name right now, who brought everything forth, used him as a scapegoat. In fact, the government should know what kind of technology they're dealing with. We all know what it is. We have always known that it can be hacked, and that there are people out there who want to know, want to get a hold of various types of information. They should have. They should. If there are very important secrets that they need to keep, then they shouldn't engage in the use of this kind of technology for them. So I just, you know, this was just an accident waiting to happen, and it is all part of having this kind of technology at our fingertips.
Janelle, thanks. Thanks for the call, Professor Wu.
I'll comment on that. You know, I'll put that comment in historical perspective. The caller is correct. The government usually likes to have a lot of control over information. I mean, everyone does, but the government is one of the particularly likes to have control over some ability to influence what is being said. Many countries, not the United States, most of the information companies have just been owned by the government, though they just make a state monopoly. In the old part of my in my book, I talk about the going back to radio. I talk about the Third Reich and its media policies, as they might be called, and they're pretty simple. They put everything. What's interesting is that an era like the Nazi government, they were very in favor of a highly centralized radio network. Why? Because then they can force everyone to listen to it. And there's this incredible point in the book, this moment in Germany where everyone has to listen to the radio for an hour. It's called the National Hour. And so everyone has to sit down for an hour. It's kind of like their version of prime time, and listen to what the leaders of the Nazi Party have to say for an hour every day. And after a while, you know, they obviously influences the population. So government has an obvious interest in controlling information. You see that with WikiLeaks. Obviously, they don't like their secrets being spilled. Government tends to like monopoly too, even though they have stated policies in favor of competition. It's often the case that a monopoly is more convenient. And I'll give you an example. During the Bush administration, one of the interests the Bush administration had was in wiretapping, and having AT&T come back as a monopolist AT&T and Verizon are basically the two phone companies today. That was very helpful to the cause of wiretapping, because when you have hundreds of companies, it's just very, very complicated. So, yes, the caller is right. The government has always had natural interest in controlling information.
Let's talk about radio a little bit,
sure.
Because it makes the radio in the early 20s makes a great, I think, analogy for the internet, particularly the early portions of it when it was really starting to explode in the 90s. And even up to today. But let's talk about what radio was like in the early 20s.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to go back even a little further into the 1910s. What's very similar about radio's origins and internet origins is it's all amateurs. Radio's origins, most radio history books don't even have this, but it really was just people building their own sets, kind of like we talk about ham wave radio people now. And you have these great magazine articles about, you know, the very few radio listeners, and they just set up their own sets. They're sort of like, hey, anyone out there? And then they do their own radio shows. And they're interesting because they're back then, every radio transmitter also has a receive and retransmit. So people are just listening to the show. If they don't like it, they can just start saying, "Hey, I don't like the show." You know, everybody's kind of a caller permanently. Those are the original radio networks. 1910 started by basically hobbyists, and it became big in the 1920s, but not yet commercial. And a very interesting period. I think this is actually, according to your website, when Wisconsin Public Radio was started in 1917, which I'm a little surprised by, but that there was just this period where it was just everyone would have a radio station the same way everyone would have a website, every group, that is. You'd have radio clubs, churches, schools, and, you know, it wasn't great. It's not, highly produced, all things considered style radio, but people just doing their thing, motorcycle clubs. And so it's exactly like the internet in the 1990s, and I think a really interesting era. And as I said, I think earlier, it was agreed that it would be crazy to have any advertising. There was this conference in 1921. Herbert Hoover said, "We cannot imagine taking this incredible scientific achievement and filling it with advertising chatter. That would be unheard of." You know, they sort of thought of it like the grand, like this incredible scientific miracle, like the Grand Canyon or something. And can you imagine putting an ad in the Grand Canyon? That seems impossible. So, you know, there's definitely the parallels are very strong between early radio and its idealism and the Internet. Unfortunately, the history of radio is a sad story because it becomes obviously incredibly commercialized, and everything we think of public radio disappears for decades until finally coming back in the late 60s, early 70s.
Well, I guess one of the things that I thought was would be interesting to discuss was, you know, at first anybody who wanted to basically could have a radio station if you could get the equipment, and there wasn't the regulation of who could be in that marketplace of ideas, and that was both good and bad, because it was good because if you had the technology, you could put yourself on the air. It was bad from the consumer's point of view because stations interfered with one another. There was this really ugly technical concept called heterodyning, which meant that it was really almost impossible to listen to the radio. And so the medium kind of it almost collapsed under its own weight. And in steps the federal government with the Federal Radio Commission, and all of a sudden all the little guys are out. And the only people left are the big players,
the big chains, as they were called, the first networks, and that would be NBC CBS. The story you've told is exactly right, and it is a sorry tale, particularly because it's the federal government that basically extinguished at the behest of the radio chains, as they were called then, much of what was then public or non-commercial radio. It's a terrible story. It's one of the worst examples of the federal government getting involved in a way which really hampers free speech. And it's striking. I mean, this is public radio is an exception, but it's amazing that back then radio was more of an outlet of free expression in the 20s than it is today. You know, trying to get a radio station started today is, forget it. You know, just forget it. It's a non-starter. And we have FM and AM now. So, yeah, there was some necessity for rules surrounding the spectrum, but basically the government had the idea that it was bigger was better, and big commercial radio chains were basically it. You know, NBC, CBS, that was the way to do things. The other problem is not only did that happen in radio, is they then allowed the radio trusts to own television. So, you know, television, when it started, most people don't think of this. Like, why did television start with NBC and CBS? Like, why? These are different media. It's not like the Internet. The first company on the Internet was NBC or CBS. TV was a different thing. But it was, this is a chapter in the book, sort of interesting, to see how TV failed to escape from radio's clutch, from Kronos, basically. Basically, TV came under the control of radio in a way that was entirely unnecessary, and in my opinion, has hurt the network, hurt TV for its entire life. I think TV has always been a stunted medium because of its ignoble birth.
Well, in truth, in some accounts, television was invented first.
Before radio?
Yeah.
A film was definitely invented before radio. It depends what you call TV, because TV is more than one technology.
The technical concepts underpinning television were developed at about the same time,
right?
And someone had developed a way to send pictures before was it Lee DeForest or Reginald Fessenden who first sent audio over the airwaves? One of the two, but they were in development at the same time, and yet radio was around for 20 or 30 years before television even got started.
That's true. The first, most people don't know this, the first TV station was in Washington, American TV station was in Washington, D.C., 1929. It wasn't, you know, these were pretty unfancy radio TV stations. But the first TV station was in 1929, and it wasn't until 1946 or so that you had what we now think of commercial, sort of the major consumer launch. And the reason was, and it's really interesting, the FCC felt it was not ready. It's just fascinating to me to have the government agency deciding this. I mean, imagine if the iPod came out or something. The government's like, or the iPad or iPod, and the government's like, no, it's not ready yet. Kick it back for another 10 years. It was an outrage, and I think it has permanently damaged television. You know, television was just born in this kind of born commercial and has always been commercial. And, you know, despite the efforts of PBS, has never really escaped from that sort of low mission.
We've got a caller who actually wants to make a comment or ask a question about radio. Let's take Stephen in Madison next. Stephen, good morning.
Good morning. My question for your guest is regarding the old analog TV spectrum that just got released for low-power radio, digital low-power radio stations.
Yeah.
And wondering what your guest's opinion on the impact of commercial radio that this is going to have. It's going to kind of be a little more freewheeling than commercial radio is right now. So
yeah, low power has been like, okay, so this, you know, this debate that the caller's talking about goes back to 1934, and I love talking about radio history because it's so much fun. Armstrong, Lee Armstrong, who is a professor at Columbia, actually, who came up with FM radio, and the thing he realized back in 1930s was that FM radio, you could have hundreds of FM radio stations as long as they were low power. And since that time, no one has ever sort of realized that promise, because commercial radio has always been opposed to lots of radio stations, because if you have lots of radio stations, then you don't have people listening to advertisements the way they're supposed to. So anyway, low-power FM has never really gotten its start, and now the FCC is trying to retool it and get it started. It always faces opposition. I'm sorry to say this from NPR, among other characters, to the start of low-power, because of this argument there's going to be interference, which is, in my opinion, often overstated as an argument. So I hope that in the future years, low-power does get its start. But I want to say this has been a debate for 75 years now, and it's been blocked every single time by commercial radio.
The spectrum given up by analog television isn't going to low-power radio, though. It's going to wireless, isn't it?
Well, the callers, there's more than one thing going on. The spectrum being given up for analog television is mostly going to cell phones, as you said, and most of it has already been auctioned off. But the truth is the FCC has low-power rules and is trying to move some efforts to try to encourage more low power stations. So I didn't want to get into the
There was just a recent rulemaking. They achieved a kind of a compromise with the National Association of Broadcasters on channel spacing, which goes back to that interference question.
Right.
And there will be more LPFMs going on the air.
But you're right. Strictly speaking, they're not exactly the same proceedings. So thank you for pointing that out. Wow, you're a real expert on this. Usually, getting into the nuts and bolts of FCC rulemakings is usually beyond our
esoteric is us. I used to teach mass communication law, so this has been and I wrote one of my master's papers on the history of broadcast regulation.
Right.
So I probably shouldn't be hosting this program. Let's get someone else's idea here, and I think Benjamin in Eau Claire has an interesting comment to make. Benjamin, thanks for holding.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, and I do think you should be hosting this. I myself am a 23-year-old, just college graduate, and I'm thoroughly interested in the Internet and just sort of the way that I think it's very much changing the landscape, the global landscape, or even a global anthropology. Like, that was something that I was thoroughly fascinated with. And I think that, and I really want to go out and get your book now, because I'm always very interested when professors will compare the old media and sort of the long duration study and look at sort of the rise and fall of these different systems. What I see is the major difference, though, and I'd like it if you speak about it, is that how the nature of the Internet, it really transcends the local. Like, it's outside of radio, it's outside of television, and, you know, the fact that I grew up, you know, living so much of my childhood life, if you can believe it, in chat rooms talking to people in other countries, and the fact that I have, you know, correspondence with teenagers in you know, nations in Afghanistan, you know, for one, and sort of the construction of dreams. I feel as though if the Internet was going to be monopolized, there would be this sort of political outrage from innumerable voices and very diverse voices. The young people, when you look at MyBarackObama.com and just the way that we've changed in an election, to imagine us losing this sort of, like, I don't know, I hate to use like these grandiose terms, but almost like a way of life or the way that so many of us have formed our identity growing up with the Internet. Like, to lose it, I think it will definitely be a bigger fight than the fight that's been going on to preserve really open spaces. And I love the original title of your book. It's a shame you can't use it. But if you could speak to that.
Sure. No, great call. And all I just want to say to you, my friend, is don't take it for granted. I agree that one of the most powerful things in keeping the Internet open has been just people who get angry when, you know, they think Comcast is trying to kill Netflix, for example. They just say, come on, this is the Internet. Or like someone's trying to speed up, CNN over Wikipedia or something, or trying to this is extremely important. But the fight is on. If you think about your wireless devices, there's a lot of question as to whether the wireless Internet will be the same kind of open medium that the wired Internet has been, and that's a big question. I want to also say what will be interesting to the listener in the book is the Internet. He's right about one thing. The Internet is a radical idea. When it was thought of its design is completely unlike anything else, any of the other information networks, and it was idealists who were doing this. Now, they had sort of practical problems to solve, but in the larger context, you can see the Internet movement and its design as a big reaction to the centralizing tendencies of the 20th century, against commercial media, against centralization of everything, against everything just being big and out of touch. It was a powerful movement. It was a kind of a 70s thing, in line with in urban design. Like the Jane Jacobs movement to try to move away from the suburbs and have more people live in cities. A lot of these movements were going on in the 70s, and the Internet was one of them, and it has continued to change society quite a bit. So I want to say I wouldn't take it for granted, but I do agree that the roots of it, and it's something I write about in a lot of depth in the book, basically what was the big idea behind the Internet and why was it radical? That's like a central question in my book.
Benjamin, thanks for that call. Let's go next to Robert in Milwaukee. Robert, good morning.
Good morning. My question is regarding net neutrality, and
sure.
The question is that good for the consumer or bad for technological advances? So who stands to benefit from it?
I think it's a great thing for consumers, and the reason is I think consumers have benefited from an environment where you have new companies able to challenge the old companies. The basic thing about the net neutrality rule is it creates an open Internet, or preserves an open Internet, so that companies can try and challenge existing monopolists. A great example right now is Netflix. So Netflix is offering streaming. I feel like I don't want to do an ad for them, but they're offering streaming video, something that the cable companies are sort of talking about but never really doing. And they're offering it for good prices, and it's a challenge to the cable monopoly. And now without the open Internet, you can't have that kind of thing happen. So I think it's really important for consumers. And even if it forces cable to respond, then it's forced them to respond. Another example, I don't know if you ever use Skype, but basically you can make long-distance calls for free or almost for free. That puts pressure on the phone companies to lower their prices, and net neutrality prevents them from killing Skype, which is a free telephone service. And I just think it's really important to have pressure on these huge companies to force them to serve consumers. Otherwise, they will not.
Of course, the other side of that argument is that from the people who are providing it, they're saying, well, look, you've got certain users who are just swallowing up enormous chunks of bandwidth, and that harms the web surfing capability of somebody else. And shouldn't we be able to manage this so that everybody has, we don't have to worry about that?
Yeah, it's a red herring because they have the right to manage it. There's an argument that is true but has nothing to do with the real issue. In other words, they have the right to manage bandwidth, first of all. And second of all, they also have the right, if they want, to charge people who use more money. So if you have someone who's using, let's say, 100 gigabytes a month versus someone who's using 1 meg, they're perfectly entitled to change the prices and have the person who uses more pay more. The companies have been a little afraid to do that, but they're perfectly within their rights to do that, and that's what they should be doing as opposed to trying. And what they want to do with net neutrality is they're like, well, first of all, we want to, stamp out our competitors, and second of all, we want to put money on Google so that we want to charge Google money or Google or eBay or other companies so that consumers don't see the price You know, so we can maybe lower our prices and get more money out of someone like Google. So the consumer, it looks like they're getting less, but then, of course, Google has more ads or has to start charging you for things. In the end, the consumer always pays. But the some of the cable or phone companies would like to hide those prices in by billing Internet companies. And the real problem for that with consumers is then nonprofit or free things or other entrepreneurs get hurt. So, you know, if everyone has to pay to be on the Internet, then how is Wikipedia supposed to pay, for example? And Wikipedia is pretty great, but it can't survive in a world where it has to pay to reach cable customers. Who, I don't know, who is the cable company in Wisconsin? I'm sorry, I don't know that.
Well, there are a number of them. I believe, let's see, I'm going to get this wrong, but Charter is a big one. I think, I'm trying to remember who's in Milwaukee as the cable provider there. I think that's right. Different. It might be Time Warner or somebody like that.
Right.
I don't remember
right.
the name of it, but I know Charter
right.
Communications is a big up where I live, which is up in the northwestern corner of the state, and
right.
and
right.
in some other cities around. And then, of course, Wisconsin, you know, is still there's a lot of rural areas in Wisconsin,
yeah.
and the whole broadband access in rural areas is a big issue in this state as well, and that's technology that really has yet to mature.
Right.
We need to take a quick break, and then
sure.
we've got full phones, and I've got about 3 pages of questions,
oh, sure.
and I know we're never going to get to them all. But I do want to talk about people like Zucor and Sarnoff and some of these, and what roles they play in your book. I really want to get to that, but we got so many great questions lined up. I'm in the talk show host dilemma here, but we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll figure it all out. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:44. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Coming up after 11, Larry Mueller talks with the author of The Species Seekers, Heroes, Fools, and the Mad Pursuit of Life on Earth. He is Richard Conniff, an award-winning magazine writer and occasional contributing columnist for NPR. That's coming up after 11, right after this show. This hour, we're talking about the new book, The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires, with Tim Wu, who wrote the book. He's professor of law at Columbia University, and he's with me on the phone, and so are a bunch of other people. And let's take some calls quickly, and we'll go to Milwaukee and talk to Jen. Jen, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Oh, boy, where do I start? First of all, net neutrality is absolutely critical to the Internet and to consumers, and I'm very glad that at least somewhat watered down but still okay agreement has come through. However, Americans, I would bet 99% of Internet users in America have no realization that our speeds that we pay for here are half and greater than half of the rest of the world. People can go do a search on transmission speeds in places like South Korea. You're going to find that their speeds at the desktop is 10 times what we have. Our American companies have that technology, but they're holding it back. I presume that they've been holding it back, hoping that the net neutrality would have gone the other way, so that they could charge us much, much more. But we are getting absolutely royally, screwed. I guess I shouldn't say that on public radio. But the money that we've been paying in our phone bills and things for broadband services out in the rural areas has been absolutely wasted. Those facilities should have been built a decade ago. And we have been paying for that, and they still do not exist. Rural users are absolutely being cheated beyond belief because of the amount of money that has gone into this concept of getting the Internet highway to everyone, and it has not happened in America, where it has happened everywhere else. Wireless does not cut it. Nothing beats a hard wire to your computer, whether it's fiber optics or copper.
Jen, thanks for the call. I want to make sure that Tim Wu has a chance to respond, and we have a lot more callers. Professor?
I think he's said it. It's a bit of a fiasco. We have a problem. We don't really take the Internet seriously as infrastructure. You know, but, I mean, what do we all depend on? It's like the electrical network. And, in fact, we pay more for it these days. When you think about what a family spends on its cell phones and cable and telephone and all of its service together, it pays more than we do for things like heat and electricity half the time. We need to take it seriously as infrastructure, as national infrastructure. We don't. We have this idea it's sort of a hobby or something, but it's actually pretty critical to both our sort of social lives and our economic lives. So I agree with the caller.
We have somebody else who wants to talk about rural broadband. Cindy in Paola, you'll be next. Cindy, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. I also wanted to ask Professor Wu about that issue of access to high-speed wired broadband and even to cable television. In my area, we don't have either, so our choices are satellite. We actually do have a wide-area wireless network, but it's a very small pipe in comparison, or, heaven forbid, dial-up. And I was wondering if the new regulations might have some effect on this so-called last-mile problem, or whether it'll take government regulation to force access for those of us.
It'll take Congress and having some willpower. The net neutrality rules don't. The FCC does not have the power to build networks. This is a serious problem. This rural broadband problem that no one takes seriously enough. It's a little like electrification. I'll just give a historical example. It was a very long time till electricity reached a lot of rural areas, and it's again because if you just rely on private companies to do it, they don't do it, or they do it at prices that are crazy. So. I suggest people study rural electrification, and what people did was they formed rural co-ops to get their own services. So maybe what we need is broadband to be created by our own rural co-ops or by cities or something, because the private sector is just not doing it. And I'll leave that there.
Cindy, thanks. Thanks for that call. Let's take another call. This time, Milwaukee and Ellen, who wants to talk about radio, my favorite subject. Ellen, good morning.
Good morning. I'm sorry I'm getting off the subject, but you know I'm an old timer, and I listen to NPR all the time while I'm doing things around the house, and I watched PBS a lot. Particularly things like Charlie Rose and that, and I think that I'm worried for it. I'm very worried. I've been hearing mumblings and grumblings. Basically, I think it's, I'm sorry to be so partisan, from the Republicans that they want to defund public television and public radio. Now, that's our last little Sebastian, last little hold on information that isn't slanted by somebody. And
right.
It scares me. It really scares me, and I wonder if anybody could speak to that.
Well, sure. I guess I'm the guest, so I will. I was on Charlie Rose's show yesterday, actually, or at least taping it. And there are these things, and I guess all I'm trying to say is if people want these things to exist, they have to make sure it happens. This stuff does not happen by accident or by the market. The government has to support it. Citizens have to support this stuff to make it happen. We decide what kind of information economy we live in. One of the things I point out in my book is that these monopolies that we end up having, in some ways, are our own creations. Everyone liked AT&T. AT&T was a good company. Everyone liked it, and so everyone used it, and it became a monopoly. Even today, with the Internet companies, I love companies like Google, but it's actually us who's making them into a monopoly by using them. And so you really have to be – citizens decide. We get the communications networks we deserve, I'm afraid, and you really have to make choices and support public media, among other things, if you want to have it. So I'll just leave that there. I knew you wanted to talk about Hollywood and stuff, so I'm trying to leave.
Yeah, I do. And Ellen, thanks for the sentiment and for being a listener. But we haven't talked about film yet, and I was particularly fascinated by your perspective on how film started out as such an open medium. Talk a little bit about the early days of film, and then how it got to be what it became.
Well, film is a really interesting story, and I can't do it justice other than suggesting readers read the chapters in the book. But if I can just do a short version of it, film actually started as a very tightly controlled monopoly under Thomas Edison. And the basic idea of film in the very early days was it was basically like a vaudeville. It was black, very short, black and white, no crediting of actors. Actors were to remain anonymous, no plot usually. and just kind of people falling around. It was just the novelty of it, and very, very heavily censored by the industry itself. And eventually that got broken up, that idea. There was a long-running battle over what film should be in the 1910s, which I describe, and the film industry opened. They broke the original monopoly and opened it up, and there was this period from about 1915, 1925, or 1930, where film was extremely open. All kinds of people were making film. There were, I think I talked about in the book, one year there was 11,585 films made, which is 11 films a day. And, you know, there was very diverse. It was sort of Irish film, there were black films, there were films for Jewish people, there were anarchist films, socialist. It was just kind of a wild time for film, sort of a YouTube era in the 1910s. Eventually, the Hollywood studios, which were the people who broke up film, reconsolidated it, and I don't want to give away the whole story, but they slowly rebuilt these highly vertically integrated structures, which we now call Hollywood, and moved it all to one city, Hollywood. And it's a great story how that happened. And one thing I guess I'll say is there was good and bad as to that. The quality, sort of the production quality of film increased, and you have the foundation for the kind of films we have today, the sort of the big blockbusters that have lots of special effects and fancy actors and so forth. But you definitely lost something at the same time, a little bit of the randomness, the kind of openness, the anything goes. Character of film disappeared. So it was a real trade-off, and I think a very fascinating episode in American history.
What do you think that you mentioned YouTube? What do you think, though? I mean, in the last decade and a half, we've seen some really quirky kind of independent films break through and achieve terrific success.
I think we're in a good age. Frankly, I am not one of these people who's pessimistic about our times. I think because of pressure from the Internet, a lot of the other media have had to become better. I think, for example, I mean, there's a lot of bad stuff on TV, but there's some really interesting stuff on TV, too, today, you know, whether it's shows like Mad Men or The Wire I like The Office. So, you know, I just think it's a pretty good time in TV, and also a lot of movie, and I just think it is the pressure. When there's more openness in the information industries, there's a lot more pressure on the big companies to do a better job. They just can't get away with doing nothing. And so I think it's been a great time. And independent film has gotten more of a shot than it did in, for example, the 1950s. And, I think it's in some ways a good time, and we have to make sure we keep it that way.
We didn't really get to talk much about television, and we really don't have time to go into it. But I would just ask you this. We've got about 3 minutes left or so. I would just ask you this. What's it going to take to prevent the Internet from going the way of the telephone, the radio, film, television, the media that you talk about in this book, and the cycle that you talk about? That reminded me of what King Solomon once said, what has been will be again. There is nothing new under the sun.
Right.
What's it going to take to keep the Internet to allow the Internet to break that cycle that you describe?
Right. So the most important thing is that you have a public awareness that we want an open media environment, dedication to that idea. And it starts with the public, with people being like, we want there to be a certain level of openness. We want there to always be a chance for new speakers to arise, even if there's a little bit of craziness around the edges. That we want, you know, we want there to be things like Wikipedia. We want there to be things like YouTube, which are not perfect, but are always a chance for just unheard voices to get heard a little bit. That's number one. The public is the most important. The government, I think, needs to share that dedication and not basically let companies run our media policy 100%. I was involved in the net neutrality discussions at the FCC, and the one thing kept striking me is we kept saying, well, what will AT&T say about these rules? And at one point I said, AT&T doesn't have a vote here. You know, we have this strange thing when government, where companies effectively have a vote. And, you know, okay, maybe they get a vote, but they shouldn't have the veto. And so government should be dedicated to the idea of, you know, America is a country about free expression. This is a First Amendment-driven country. And that means not just no government censorship, but we need to have an open media environment. And I think those are the two most important things. I'll just add to it one little thing. I think this is a little plug for my book, but understanding the history of this and the importance is really, you know, just like the callers today have been people who are into this, and I think that makes a huge difference. Nothing is more important or more powerful than people who get angry when things go wrong. and who put pressure on government to do the right thing.
Well, the important thing is to get angry at the right time and make sure we don't wait until the horse is out of the barn to close the door.
That's true, and it's hard to know. I mean, people have jobs and they're busy and they're doing things, and this stuff happens. So it is important to have public representatives who are paying attention. I think you need a little. It's important. This is sort of an interesting comparison to the slow food movement. I think a lot of people are a lot more aware now of what kind of food they eat, you know, and they're sort of paying attention to where it comes from and so on. You might try that with information. Like, how much of the information am I digesting is sort of, more commercial, supported by commercial sources? How much of it is publicly funded? How much of it is purely amateur? It's really just interesting to look at your media diet and ask, like, huh, what am I eating here? Like, where is it all coming from? How much is public radio? Yeah.
That reminds me, it's almost lunchtime, and we're out of time. Yeah, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but I'd love to have a conversation with you again about this. It's just fascinating. Tim Wu, professor of law at Columbia University, author of The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning with on-air production by Erica Janik. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Hey, tomorrow morning this hour we're going to talk about Mickey Mantle on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.